We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Wednesday, February 12th, and we are just rocking and rolling along with America First policies, including the AI summit. This is the third annual summit that was over in Paris. And I got to say, the thing that was most laughable about this is hearing Macron in his little French accent going, drill, baby, drill. And I was like, you just don't sound that impressive in trying to troll Trump. I wish we had a clip of this. I looked for it, but I was just laughing so hard because, you know, he just really can't stand up to Trump. But this was Vice President J.D. Vance's first foreign speech, and he said that the U.S. would continue to dominate in artificial intelligence. And it was really great, I think, seeing a millennial and a younger person who actually probably uses AI, who understands the technology, has grown up with technology, actually addressing a lot of these issues. And this goes back to all of the tech policy and the tech bill of rights that the Trump campaign released very early on. I mean, this, we're talking like 2022. I know that was a long time ago in American history. But a lot of this is really shaping how we are going to view the culture. And I think the culture overall is changing. And that's the topic for our first segment, especially with the recent Super Bowl ads. And I want to focus on a piece from The Washington Times this morning that the headline is this: transgender friendly Nike hit with blowback for ad extolling women's sports. So it goes on to say, Nike has championed male-born competitors in women's sports for years, which is why its Super Bowl ad paying tribute to female athletes was accused of being hypocritical, not to mention a few decades behind the times. The sportswear giant unveiled its "So Win" brand motto during the game Sunday with an ad predicated on the assumption that girls and women are discouraged from excelling at sports. So the ad featured women sports stars and had one of the rappers, apparently, who narrates the 1 minute commercial saying, "Whatever you do, you can't win, so win." So the critics called the ad's message outdated. Not only have female sports grown in popularity, but the ad ignores the biggest current issue in women's athletics: the rise of biological males competing based on gender identity. So I understand that controversy. I had a little bit of a different take. I think that because the culture is shifting, and I watched the Super Bowl because President Trump was there for the first time in probably since like 2015, I think. I mean, it's been on in the background, but I actually sat there and watched it. And I watched the commercials because I was interested in the cultural commentary. And this, to me, showed that Nike was at least backing off very observably from their woke push. There's been a lot of boycotts of Nike since the whole Colin Kaepernick ridiculous fiasco, and of course with the athletes that were kneeling for the national anthem. I mean, so many different controversies, not to mention Nike supporting this whole transgender movement. So to me, even though this commercial, yes, granted, could have been a lot stronger and a lot better, and you know, Nike isn't really a conservative company, it at least showed, I think, an admission that the woke era and pushing that message, they have conceded that, because they were at least acknowledging that women's sports are women's sports. And yes, the message was antiquated that somehow, you know, women don't have equality in today's society, especially sports, which I think is totally absurd. But it at least showed that we are shifting as a culture. So let's welcome in Orrin McIntyre, who's a host at The Blaze. And Orrin, you know, I was very pleased to see a lot of these types of commercials that weren't just pushing the leftist woke agenda, even for a company like Nike, to have something that was acknowledging that women are women and men are men. I think that's a win.
Well, there are certainly fewer woke commercials this time around. You can probably put them on your hand this time instead of it being the majority of what we were seeing. The NFL flag football one was particularly egregious. That was probably the worst one by far. But in general, it did seem like there was a shift in the majority of the tone, if not to anything positive about America or, you know, anti-wokeness, at least it was relatively neutral. I will say that this Nike commercial, yeah, is it great that we weren't, you know, subjected to a bunch of trans athletes in this? Yes, I guess ultimately. But the big thing is really that this felt like peeling one layer off the revolution, right? Like, yes, it's not featuring a bunch of trans athletes, but we still have to go through the idea, the struggle session of, well, you know, this is how women are told to behave, and we're going to rebel against how women are told to behave. I mean, a number of the behaviors listed in the advertisement were just immoral behaviors, like how to be selfish, how to only care about yourself, how to put yourself first. Like, these are the things that were being promoted in the commercial. So is it better than open trans worship? Yeah, absolutely. Does it show that there's some level of turning a corner on that issue in the culture? Yes, and that is positive. But ultimately, the message in there was still anachronistic and just, frankly, immoral and negative in general.
Yeah, and definitely, and I agree with you on that. I mean, it's not to say that this was a great commercial or that, you know, potentially we as conservatives and Christians who've been boycotting Nike for a while should revisit this and say, oh, wow, just because they're not shoving the trans message down our throat now, suddenly, you know, this is great and we're all done and the culture war has been won. But I think that this sort of incremental rolling back, it is at least a significant win, because these brands are recognizing that pushing the woke leftist agenda is not working. And it's not working not only for their bottom line, but not even to advance the culture war. If they're caring about things like their points with the human rights campaign and all of this ridiculous nonsense with, you know, the Bud Light type of controversy, John Deere, all of those things, they're recognizing that that isn't ground that they can win. And that, I think, speaks well of where conservatives overall and just truth and basic common sense is moving in the culture.
Yeah, you can tell that the Democratic Party and the political left are still holding fast to wokeness. We just had the New York Times cut a piece about how what a tragedy it is that Donald Trump is walking away from, like, trans kids. We've had multiple different representatives on the House floor talking about how, you know, white people are the problem. Same thing over at CNN. You get anchors still spouting that stuff. But it's clear that corporate America recognizes the shift, that even if the political left is still firmly ensconced in their woke bunker, that the people who are running advertisements, recognizing what makes culture, what, you know, putting out movies, these kind of things, they're seeing that kind of the woke obsession is something that's got very low return on it at this point. Now, I would like to see, and I think we should continue to push to see, not just some attempt to roll things back 5 years ago to what was never neutrality, but people acted as if this was somehow neutral, that things were only somewhat leftist instead of radically left in all of our corporate messaging. I'd like to see the pendulum truly shift in the other direction. I think that it's good to, as you're saying, recognize that a change is happening, but also recognize that we don't want to just stop in, you know, the last revolution. We don't just want to go back slightly to the middle of the last revolution where it seemed almost kind of reasonable. We actually want to see cultural momentum shift the other direction. And so, yes, it's great that we're not, again, getting trans athletes in our feminist ad, but the fact that we're still getting an ad that pretends like women are being oppressed and it's so important for all of these women to break out of the mold and be as selfish as possible and promote themselves as much as possible because that's what life's all about. Like, a win in the sense, like you said, we're feeling the momentum head the other direction, but there's still a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, well said. And I'm speaking with Orrin McIntyre, who is a host at The Blaze, and you can follow him on X. I'd encourage you to do so. And, you know, I think that this also, in terms of not stopping here and moving forward to seeing how much this pervasive leftism has become so entrenched and embedded in not only American society and the culture and all aspects, but even abroad, we're seeing that especially with all of the revelations that are coming out with USAID, and now all of the reports as well that some of these NGOs were actually funding reportedly illegal immigration, even human trafficking. I mean, you know, so many of these things. And of course, religious organizations are pushing back and saying, you know, well, you have to continue to fund us because, hey, First Amendment. And I'm thinking, no, the First Amendment doesn't actually cover some of those activities. But we're seeing how much the U.S. government was pushing these ideologies, not just these companies that are private and, you know, they can say whatever message they want and we're free to boycott them for that message. But when it comes to government, that's a totally different story. And as an American taxpayer, that's not only irresponsible, but I think abusive of our taxpayer funds to go to these types of activities that clearly the majority of the American people do not support.
Yeah, again, it's it would be bad enough if the left was just stealing American taxpayer dollars and giving it to their friends, right? That's political patronage, whether we like it or not. That is a part of politics and always will be. But that would be fraud, like that would be graft, right? But it's much worse than that. It's that they're not just taking that money and handing it to their friends. It's that they're actively funding these really horrible, evil things overseas. We're funding the corruption of children, the grooming of children, the secularization of children, you know, paying for increasing atheism in Nepal or increasing transgender education in the Balkans or, you know, funding some kind of transgender comic book in Peru. You know, this isn't just stupid stuff. It's not just graft or waste or fraud or abuse. It's straight up evil stuff that we're funding. And the worst part for people who listen to your show probably is the revelation that several of the worst actors in kind of the big evangelical movement ended up being funded by the government as well. As you said, when it comes to the NGOs, many of them attached to churches doing human trafficking. We have the Lutheran church talking about how they can teach illegal immigrants to deceive law enforcement officers. We find out that places like Christianity Today and David French's organization are funded by the U.S. government. A lot of the people who are running around calling Trump a scary Christian nationalist and saying that no Christian could ever vote for Trump were literally paid by the government to do so. That should be a scandal across the entire Christian community.
Absolutely. It really should. And I think that as more light is shed on this, we're going to start seeing the contrast between genuine conservative Christians who are promoting biblical values and truth, and then a lot of these other so-called Christian organizations that are actually being funded by or simply partnering with leftist ideologies to push this. And this is where Meg Basham's book, Shepherds for Sale, I think is so very timely. For those who haven't yet read that, I would strongly encourage you to read that. The message is so timely. But Orrin, just in the last minute we have here, where do you think DOGE is going here in terms of finding and uncovering even more of this corruption as, you know, the left is rapidly filing for injunctions? I don't think that they'll end up being successful on that front.
Yeah, the Trump administration really needs to make sure that it ignores any legal injunctions to its ability and wins battles on those that it can. But ultimately, you know, Elon and Trump are throwing around all kinds of ideas. You've got them talking about auditing the Pentagon. You've got them talking about, you know, sending Ron Paul to the Federal Reserve. I mean, all of these are fantastic ideas. You know, USAID was just the tip of the iceberg. It's the most obvious and corrupt of these organizations because it was this black box that was unaccountable and really was just a slush fund for pushing leftist ideas overseas. But what we're going to see is that this, you know, leftist progressive ideological patronage network works its way through all of the government. It's not just in this one little boutique thing that goes out and influences foreign nations. It is very active here at home. The revolution was funded with your tax dollars, and that's what we're going to see over and over again.
And that is hopefully what is being currently dismantled as we speak. Orrin McIntyre, always appreciate you joining. You can follow him at Orrin McIntyre, A-U-R-O-N, Orrin McIntyre on X. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we turn to the situation in Israel with this headline coming from allisrael.com. Netanyahu threatens IDF will resume intense fighting if hostages not released by Saturday. The IDF announces reinforcement of troops and mobilization of reservists in preparation for return to fighting. So following the ultimatum by President Donald Trump on Monday, calling for all hostages to be released by Saturday at noon or the ceasefire would be called off, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu echoed that call on Tuesday evening. He said in an official statement, quote, "I have just finished an in-depth 4-hour security cabinet meeting. We all expressed outrage over the shocking state of our 3 hostages who were released last Saturday. We all welcomed President Trump's demand to release our hostages by Saturday noon as well, and we all welcomed the president's revolutionary vision for the future of Gaza." So Joel Rosenberg, who is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News, and you can find that at allisrael.com and also follow him on X at Joel C. Rosenberg, joins me now. So Joel, I think we were all shocked at the pictures and the videos of these hostages being returned. I mean, just the stunning contrast between what these individuals looked like before and after their absolutely horrendous captivity is just horrific.
It is, Jenna. These images really look like the Holocaust survivors coming out of Auschwitz in 1945. This is creating a new level of trauma, of shock inside Israel. You know, we have this expression that not only Jews, but Christians and people of goodwill all over the world have been saying since 1945, never again. And yet for almost 500 days, Israeli and American and other nationality hostages have been held in these terror dungeons, and they are being tortured, and the women are being sexually abused, and they are all being starved, and we are seeing near skeletons coming out. Some of the hostages have been treated a little bit better than others, but these last 3 men that came out, these are emaciated men who have been nearly starved to death. And I am grateful to President Trump, who is not taking this anymore. He's sickened by it. And then when Hamas said, on Monday that they're going to stop giving even releasing hostages based on alleged Israeli violations of the ceasefire deal. Trump had it, and he said, "Forget it. Everybody has to be out. Every hostage has to be out by noon on Saturday, or the ceasefire is over, and all hell will be unleashed, and Israel will be free to go in and crush Hamas once and for all." And you know, I don't know why. I can't explain why President Biden never had the wherewithal, the courage, the moral fortitude to say something like that. God bless President Trump.
You know, amen to that. And I think these pictures and seeing the condition of these hostages just created an even greater sense of urgency, because you're right, I think, to analogize this to Holocaust survivors. I mean, there are very few things in modern American history that, you know, we can rightly compare to that era. And of course, you know, the left would love to compare Trump to being a Nazi and all this ridiculous stuff. But that comparison is so apt that this has created an even greater sense of urgency. So where does that leave Hamas? Because as your piece mentions, it's unlikely that they will meet that Saturday deadline.
Well, all Israel News has been trying to, you know, cover this from multiple angles, and it is a complex story. But in this case, here's the main issue. Hamas is playing a game. The game is they took hostages, they tortured them, they sexually abused them, they are starving them, and then they are releasing them in dribs and drabs, a little bit here, a little bit there. Why? They're releasing them only to get terrorists, Hamas and other radical Islamist Palestinian terrorists, out of Israeli prisons. Terrorists who have blood on their hands, who've murdered, in some cases, dozens of Israelis, who've raped Israelis, who've tortured Israelis. Like, and so Hamas is using innocent hostages as pawns to get actual convicted bloodthirsty terrorists. And so now, Israel didn't want to do it. President Trump got the deal done. He's like, and he said to Netanyahu, "Look, I get you don't want to do this. I get it, but I'm with you, and I'm going to help you one step at a time. It's not like Biden; those days are over. This idea of tying one hand behind your back, not giving you the weapons you need, not giving you the political and moral support that you need to get the job done. No, but but President Trump, through Steve Witkoff, this really impressive new special envoy to the Middle East, basically was able to say to Netanyahu, "Look, you're going to make a bad deal. I get it, but we're with you, and you're not going to be abandoned on the other side." But as this deal has started to unravel, in which Hamas is again in playing even worse games, and you can see now, in the first few hostages, you know, were in not good shape, but they weren't as bad as these three men, and so this just fueled President Trump's anger and his sympathy, anger against Hamas, sympathy for Israel, and saying, "No, we are not playing this game, not with the United States, not with our ally. It's over." And this is type of moral outrage that we could have used for almost 500 days prior. But hey, Trump is here, and you can't accuse Trump of not trying to make a good deal. He made the best deal he could. We've gotten about 20 hostages out so far. But here's the other question that we have to ask. We don't know, you and I, Jenna, as we talk, U.S. intelligence probably knows, Israeli intelligence probably knows, how many live hostages are left. Now, we want every single one of them out, but the clock is ticking, and Trump is putting a deadline. You could say he's taking a risk. You could say he's risking the lives of the other live hostages, but their lives are already at risk. And this is, you know, Trump is basically saying, "We're not going to be treated this way. Our ally will not be treated this way." But then you've got lots of other complications we haven't even got to yet, which is Jordan, Egypt, the future of Gaza. This is a Rubik's Cube that Trump is trying to solve, and it is not easy.
You're absolutely right about that. Joel Rosenberg, my special guest this morning, editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can find all of those great headlines at allisrael.com. And that is a very important question of how many are left. I think we have kind of a ballpark number, but I think that also raises potentially the possibility that Hamas could offer a few hostages and say that's it, that's all that remain in order to try to still keep this ceasefire deal in place. I mean, what are we kind of expecting potentially as some scenarios for their response before Saturday noon?
Well, this is the question that we've been struggling with as Israelis, is that everybody has sort of feared that, you know, in the deal that would have released a total of 38 hostages, 33 Israelis and five Thai hostages, and the five Thai hostages have been released. And the American Israeli that was held hostage, Keith Siegel, he has been released. So that's good. We're grateful for all that have come out. But we've always feared in Israel that not all 33 or 38 in the first round would be alive. And so we've been waiting for what's the moment that we're going to see body bags come out or coffins. Now, one of the biggest questions is, where is the Bibas family? The father of this beautiful young family, Yarden Bibas, was released. But he was released, and his wife and his two beautiful sons, redhead, just adorable sons. One was 9 months old when he was taken hostage. One was a little over 2 years old or 3 years old. Anyway, they are nowhere to be seen. They should have been released first. Where are they? Where is this mother? Where is the Bibas mother? Where are these Bibas boys? A mother and two babies should have been released in the first release. Where are they? Well, Hamas won't tell us. So again, this is the type of craziness. This is so wicked. It's so evil, and it's gone on for 500 days, and we're all fearing that they're dead. We don't know, but this idea of Trump projecting strength and saying, look, we are not doing this. We are not letting Hamas run the world. It's not going to happen. This is such a breath of fresh air. President Trump's press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu, the most pro-Israel press conference in a White House in history. Like, it was astonishing. There is no daylight anymore between Israel and the United States. There's no twisting Israel's arm as though Israel's the problem here. There's no, you know, demanding Israel give a ceasefire, which means really surrender to Hamas. No, there was a projection of American strength, American leadership. In fact, I've never seen Benjamin Netanyahu so happy. I've personally known him for 25 years. We're not close, but I worked for him briefly 25 years ago, and I've met with him over the years and tracked his career. I've never seen him so happy, because he finally has an actual robust ally who's not going to take any crap from the world's worst terrorist organization. You know, and then there's all the other things that Trump is saying. You know, look, we're not going to wait for the rest of the world to harass Netanyahu about what's the day after plan. Netanyahu's dealing with today, and today is trying to get our hostages out and defeat this terrorist organization. So Trump showed leadership. He said, you know what? The Arabs haven't come up with a plan to fix Gaza, and the UN hasn't, and the European Union hasn't, and NATO hasn't, and nobody has, so I will. And, you know, is it going to be easy? No, but we're going to get this thing done. And Trump started to lay out a vision that is shocking. Now, you could talk about some of the details. I don't know if we have the time, but the point is, this is American leadership. This is, all right, we'll fix it. No one else will step forward in almost 500 days. We will do it, and we will stand by our allies. And in the end, you know, as much respect as I have for these Arab leaders and the Arab people, and I know many of these Arab leaders personally, me, Joel, I know them, and I am sympathetic for their position. But where's your plan? You know, you haven't fixed this thing. You haven't offered one creative solution. The president is in the game now. He's like, then it's going to be my solution. And my solution is going to be best for my ally, Israel. I have other allies, Arab allies, but you guys haven't stepped up. These are Arabs in Gaza. You're not offering to take them. You're not offering to help them. You're not even offering to pay. So we're going to change that. That is leadership. And they're all set on their heels, these Arab leaders. My friend, King Abdullah of Jordan, yesterday, President al-Sisi isn't even going to show up. He was invited to the White House, and now he's not going to show up because Trump wants him to take 1 million or maybe even 2 million and build housing in the Sinai, which is a massive swath of unpopulated territory. President El-Sisi doesn't want to do it. Okay, well, then there's going to be some consequences, President Trump is saying. So there's a lot going on here. And then we've got, you know, you could put these refugees in Syria. You could put them in other countries. But how is it possible that Palestinians who are traumatized in Gaza and live in an apocalyptic wasteland of their own making, of Hamas's own making, why is it exactly that no Arab country will open their doors and say, we will help you. We will take care of you. We will show compassion. Literally, you have to say trapped, locked up in Gaza? And whether it's a temporary transition or not, nobody's willing to help? Trump is really exposing some serious problems in the Arab world right now, some hypocrisy when it comes to compassion. You know, there's all this criticism of Israel, but there's 500 million Arabs. No leader of one of these countries is willing to say, yes, I will help. I'm astonished, but more astonished that Trump is showing such impressive leadership after, I mean, the contrast between Biden and Trump every day of the last 3 or 4 weeks has been so astonishing. It's really pretty impressive, but we got to keep praying because it's not easy, and the way forward is not going to be an easy path.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could not agree more, Joel Rosenberg, that the contrast between Trump and Biden is just literally day and night in every single respect in any issue that we're discussing over the last 3 weeks,
exactly.
And now about three
Mexico,
and a half weeks.
Mexico, yeah. Canada, Panama, Greenland, China, wow. Trump, the Gulf of America, Trump is asserting American, not just leadership, but dominance. We are a superpower again. We're not acting like a superpower until January 20th. And now suddenly the superpower is back.
America is back, and that's actually the flag banner across all of the social media accounts that are official Trump 47, and the White House account, the POTUS account, the press secretary is America is back, and I think a lot of us really feel that. And before I let you go, Joel Rosenberg, I wanted to ask one more question about Trump's leadership and vision for Gaza specifically. There have been some mixed reactions to what he's proposing for the Gaza Strip.
That's a gentle way to put the mixed reactions. I like that.
Well, trying hard, but where do you fall in that spectrum of reactions on how serious some of these proposals are, or is this more a negotiation tactic?
Well, I've been meeting with Arab officials in the region and here in Washington in recent weeks. I've been meeting with senior administration officials, and my impression is that I don't know. Let me start out by saying, I think President Trump's instincts are very powerful and impressive. He is showing compassion for the Palestinians of Gaza, right? He's saying, look, I just sent Steve Witkoff in, and he evaluated the situation. He said, it's an apocalyptic wasteland. You can't build this thing out in 3 years. It's going to take 10 to 15. So we're going to clear it. We're going to rebuild it. We're going to secure it. We're going to make it fantastic. Gaza's going to be fantastic, Jenna.
And Mara Gaza.
We're going to make Gaza great again. Yeah, Gaza was never great, but we're going to make it great. So that's compassion. He's not doing it to be mean. He's doing it because he's like, there is no other way. I know how to do real estate, and you can't have a world, a land of unexploded ordnance and live ammunition and buildings about to collapse and tunnels about to collapse. You can't have 2 million people just walking around in there. Plus, they need homes. They need air conditioning. They need heat. They need water. They need sanitation. I think we're seeing Trump's, compassion, his heart. Now, where I can't tell you, does he really mean that he's going to move 2 million Palestinians out and they're never going to go back? That's what he told Bret Baier on Fox. That's what has got the Arab leaders upset. It's not that they don't appreciate. The Arab leaders do appreciate, let's put it in the positive, Trump's wanting to take the lead. They're totally good with that. King Abdullah's good with that. President Sisi's good with that. What they don't want to see is displacement permanently, but they don't even seem to want a displacement, Palestinians moving out, even for 10 years while it's rebuilding. That's the problem. That's where Trump is sort of revealing that their attitude, which is, wait, you're 5 million. You guys all took in 5 million Syrians when there was a catastrophe there. You're not going to take in any Palestinians. So my point is, this is a question that I don't know the answer. Is, you know, Trump often puts out what looks like extreme bargaining position, and everybody goes, oh, that's crazy. And then they all retreat to a bold position, and he's like, good, all right, I'll take it. And he gets something far bolder, far more bold than his interlocutor would have agreed to the day before, because it all feels like a retreat from something crazy. That's what just happened with Mexico and Canada, right? I'm going to impose 25% tariffs Tuesday, and that's it. You guys aren't going to play ball and make a better deal. Fine. And then they get all nervous. Then they negotiate. And then he gets something better than he would have gotten. Same thing with Panama. We're going to take over the Panama Canal. We didn't give it to the Chinese. It's not going to happen. But then suddenly Rubio goes down there, and the Panamanian president goes, oh, fine, fine, fine. We'll leave China. We'll come back to the United States and the embrace of the United States. Good. Good. This is the world starting to listen. Now, is that what Trump means when it comes to Gaza? I'm not sure, but he certainly has a maximalist position that's causing everybody to go, what's going on? And Rubio made an interesting point. He said, you know, he said it on XM radio the other day, Trump's the only one who has a plan. If you have a better plan in the Arab world, put it up, put it forward. We're willing to listen, but this idea that you're going to do nothing and you're going to berate Israel for not having a plan, these are Arab citizens. These are Arab people. These are Palestinians. How come you guys don't have a plan? Put it forward. Now, the Egyptians say they're going to put a plan together, but President Sisi has just canceled a trip to come and meet with the president. That's not good. I like President Sisi of Egypt. I respect him. This is not a good idea. He should be getting on a plane and coming here to talk to the president. You don't get yourself in a position where you are seen as an American ally who won't talk to the president of the United States. There's a new sheriff in town, and he does not like being disrespected, nor should he. Trump, you know, if the Egyptians have a plan, wonderful, lay it out, talk to the president, but don't vote him off. That is not going to go well for the people of Egypt.
Well said. Well, Joel Rosenberg, always appreciate your insights as always. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this new sheriff in town handles the foreign policy on the world stage. But this is a demand, basically, that at least that Israel is respected and that hopefully the hostages will be returned. And I am so grateful for that contrast between Trump and Biden. We need a U.S. president that is strong on Israel, strong on all of these things, strong on America first, of course, and in all of these different subject matters. This could not be a better contrast between Trump and Biden. So follow Joel Rosenberg at Joel C. Rosenberg on X, and follow all of the headlines at allisrael.com. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as we are all awaiting President Trump actually completely disbanding the U.S. Department of Education, and I hope that he is ultimately successful in doing that, his current U.S. DOE is still making some really good moves, including some headlines like this. The U.S. Department of Education this coming January 31st says it will return to enforcing Title IX protections on the basis of biological sex in schools and on campuses. Related content is the U.S. Department of Ed urges the NCAA, the NFHS, to restore female athletics records wrongfully erased by male competitors. And also, just on Monday, the U.S. Department of Ed reduces burden on career and technical education programs. And all of that is highlighted under acting Undersecretary James Bergeron said, quote, the Trump Education Department is committed to strengthening our career and technical workforce and equipping students with the tools they need to excel. The 11th hour Biden-Harris information collection on CTE, which is a career and technical education programs, was unnecessary bureaucratic red tape that would only drive up costs and hinder innovation. So how does this actually impact some of the state education? Well, Commissioner of Education here in Florida, Manny Diaz, joins me now. So all of these, to me, are really great headlines.
Yeah, Jenna, great to be with you this morning. And it's great to see the progress beginning of that promise of reducing the regulatory burden and just the total bureaucracy of what has been the failed lifetime of the U.S. Department of Education starting in the Carter administration. So I applaud that. I think there's a lot more that can be done, and I expect to see some more action coming forward from the Trump administration on this key issue.
So what is Florida specifically encouraging the Trump administration within the Department of Ed to do?
Well, look, there's a series of things that could be done to stop short of, you know, abolishing the department, which that would require congressional action. But I think, you know, consolidating all of the K-12 federal grant funding into a single block grant and returning that control to the states. When people talk about returning control to the states, you know, under the Constitution of the United States, education is a state responsibility and right. And so by allowing states to determine methodologies and data sources within state allocations, by maximizing states' use of funds that have been limited by defined buckets and varying timelines, by ensuring states can utilize funds to grow various pathways for successful student outcomes instead of boxing us in. Every state is different. Every state has different issues, different demographics. And in order to encourage that innovation, including within the charter school space and within the choice space, which in Florida, you know, we have over 500,000 students now on our educational savings accounts, the Family Empowerment Scholarship. We also have over 400,000 students in charter schools. And what's gone on is this just myriad of Byzantine paperwork that has to be done to comply with checkboxes and just silly regulations from the federal government, which hampers the effectiveness of those dollars. Because if you have a problem at the state level, something that I can see as you know, basically the Secretary of Education of the state of Florida, then we can address those problems if we have flexibility within those dollars. They pat themselves on the back. You know, Congress funds this. They send it down. They pat themselves on the back. But the truth is we haven't seen any results in the decades that the department has existed. So really cutting off the limitations, including, you know, transforming some of the higher ed grants, the Perkins grant, having the ability to have local and tailored responses and increasing that flexibility, again, to try to allow states to really cater programs and customize programs to what is necessary in response to the needs of that state.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Commissioner, that every state is different, and also states should not be tied by the bureaucratic red tape or tied in receiving that funding to whatever the rules and regulations are of the Department of Ed, because education is constitutionally a subject matter and a power that's given to the states and even to we the people. I believe constitutionally that parents have a right to direct the education choices, and if we have school choice and for example, parents want to homeschool, then our tax dollars shouldn't be forced to go to fund government-funded institutions, but should follow the students. And we shouldn't have to basically expend resources multiple times over just because there should be choice in terms of education. And so, you know, the opposition to a lot of this, especially on the federal level, and from teachers unions and all of this that are pushing back against what Trump is doing in the Department of Ed, is saying, well, you know, if we change all of this and, you know, we get rid of the Department of Ed or even change how the funding sources go or have school choice, then that's ultimately going to necessarily negatively impact government funded schools. I don't see really any statistics or facts to support that opinion, do you?
No, and I think that, look, you have to start with the premise that that I don't agree with. Their view on it, the teachers' union view on it, is that public education means that the education is provided by a government institution, and the unions have a stranglehold on the schools and school districts, and the ability to push what has turned into a cultural war. Right? Teachers' unions were supposed to be looking out for the best interests of teachers, and they're looking at, you know, getting into the cultural fights, whether it be abortion or whether it be critical race theory or other social issues. And I think what happens here is when you provide that flexibility and you provide the parents to have control, which is what we have in Florida with universal choice, have parents have control of what's the best setting for that individual child. They look at it as a collective. We look at it as every child is different and they have individual needs and we need to find the best setting. And the government shouldn't be the one that determines what that setting is. We've all agreed that we should fund education, but that should be in the hands of the parent, which is the child's first teacher. By allowing this flexibility, it would allow us not to only expand choice options and let parents determine what that setting looks like, but also to move the resources that come from the, you know, if the dollars are appropriated by Congress, move those resources to places where it actually works. Where can we create programs where we base our programs here based on the science of reading, right? We know very clearly now that students in primary grades, kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, that is the foundational piece. And if you can't get it right there, then you're going to be trailing that, and nothing really works to catch those students up. Well, let us put those resources in those places and don't lock us into demographic buckets. Every student, regardless of race, color, or creed, should have the opportunity to get on reading level, should have the opportunity to be able to do basic math and set that foundation for their future. But if you're pigeonholing states and into certain demographic buckets, you're not really going to be able to address that problem. Number two, we have to remember that all this is they're collecting these dollars from residents of states like the state of Florida, and then they're recycling them and sending them back with strings attached. That doesn't work. Nobody in that building in Washington with over 4,000 employees knows what's best for students in Florida. And the mere fact is they weren't even coming to work. So you just had an empty building with a bunch of bureaucrats that are spread all over the place doing the bare minimum. But sure enough, finding the opportunity to create obstacles for states to do things that are necessary. What we do here in Florida is not necessarily going to work in Connecticut. It's not going to work in Maine. It's not going to work in California. But we do have the opportunity, like we have done, to lead by what states are supposed to be, laboratories of experiments. And what's happened here in Florida, as you clearly know, we've led on school choice. Other states have followed our lead. And so how do you augment, supplement that, and pour these funds into things that are working, not pour them and have to spend them on a myriad of programs that are dictated by the federal government, which then come with a series of check boxes and a number of employee hours that we have to use at the state level just to do compliance with what the feds are telling us to do, even though it may not work.
Yeah, and what a waste of time and resources. And I think you're absolutely right, Commissioner. And you can follow Commissioner Manny Diaz on X. I'd encourage you to do so at COMM for Commissioner, Commissioner Manny Diaz Jr. And I think you're absolutely right that this has become a cultural battle for the teachers unions, for the woke left. This is why Christian conservatives would call some government schools indoctrination camps, because they're more concerned about the ideology than they are actually serving the students, serving the parents, and having effective programs. This is why school choice ultimately matters, and why I'm grateful that Florida is leading on this. In the last just minute I have with you here, how do you see the contrast with the Trump admin versus what we had under Biden?
Well, immediately a sense of liberation, because we were fighting at the forefront of that Title IX battle. Fortunately, the Trump administration came in, and even though the courts had stopped it, removed that ridiculous attempt at changing the law where it was removing protections for girls and women in sports and in their locker rooms and dressing rooms. And then the other thing is the opportunity to really have a conversation about using these funds. For example, in Florida, we know that content is important. So how do we leverage those dollars to make sure that our students have quality content when they're learning to assure that we're back to the main mission of education and not all of this indoctrination that has been attempted across the time.
We'll keep up the great work. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.